When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Jim McCormick.
And before we get going here, just a couple of things I want to throw out. First of all, StuffToBlowYourMind.com. That is the mothership. That's where you need to go if you want to check out all of our podcast episodes, videos, blog posts, links out to social media accounts, including the landing page for this episode, which we'll be sure to fill up with links to related content as well as some key outside sources.
At the time we're recording this, our other co-host, Christian, just put up a wonderful gallery about MDMA.
That's right, tying into a previous two-parter we did on MDMA/ecstasy. And number two, you want to help out the podcast here? Do you listen to us via iTunes? If you do, why don't you check out that iTunes page and throw a nice review up there for us. Give us a nice, some nice fresh feedback on how we're doing here, just to tweak that algorithm a little more in our favor and help the show continue on as it has been.
All right, Robert, I noticed something about you.
Ah, what's that, Joe?
I notice you have blonde hair.
I do. Naturally occurring blonde hair.
Naturally, so you don't dye.
No, it just grows out of my head this way.
And you weren't struck by lightning or affected in some way by a god?
No. I didn't witness any kind of pan-dimensional being and have my hair change color as is wont to happen.
You know? Okay, so one can assume that you get your blonde hair from your genes.
Yes.
So you inherited it from your parents, right?
That's right. Nice and vertical.
And there's nowhere else you could have gotten it from, right?
Well, unless I happen to have a run-in with a gene stealer.
Now, what is a gene stealer, Robert?
Well, a gene stealer, this is, in this episode, we're going to be talking about horizontal gene transfer, which is a very real thing. But my first exposure to this topic really came in the form of tabletop gaming science fiction, specifically the Warhammer 40,000 universe.
Hold on, I'm putting on my seatbelt. Okay, Robert, Warhammer 40,000.
Yes.
Tell me.
Okay, without getting just too geeky about it all, and I know some of our listeners are certainly fans, if not of the tabletop game, then some of the video games and that have spun out of it and the overall world, the sort of expanded universe of it all. But yeah, this is a tabletop board game in which far future fantasy armies battle each other. It started out in the UK as this kind of just sci-fi upgrade of an existing fantasy world that itself was kind of an amalgam of different elements, you know, Tolkien and Dungeons and Dragons and all these
Conan
things.
The Barbarian?
Conan the Barbarian, for
of
sure.
Course.
All of it, you know, wrapped up into one. And then they took it, they put it in the far future, and then other elements began to spill into it.
So it's kind of a beautiful genre mutt.
Yeah, you know, they ended up borrowing a little bit here, a little bit here, and so if you look at Warhammer 40,000 as a universe, you can definitely see bits and pieces of everything else. A little Aliens, a little Hellraiser here and there, Event Horizon, you name it, it probably has wormed its way in there at some point or another. Terminator, certainly. But it still feels very unique and exciting, and I've always been a fan of it.
Well, we all love space monsters here. I get that you're heading towards a particular space monster.
Yes, the Tyranid Gene Stealer. This is an infiltration branch of an all-consuming hive mind from another galaxy.
Okay.
And the way that this plays out in the game world is that the Tyranid hive fleet is headed towards our galaxy
okay.
in this far future scenario. And so it deploys this gene stealer species ahead of time to a chosen planet. And so these gene stealers are big, hulking, six-limbed killers. They're deadly in a stand-up fight, but their ultimate aim is to infect members of the planet's intelligent population with their own genetic material. They use an ovipositor-like tongue. They inject a tiny embryonic mass into the host organism. And this seed is largely inert, but it carries out three primary functions.
Okay.
Okay, so it psychically enslaves the host mind to a localized version of the Tyranid hive mind.
Okay, so it's like one of those brain-stealing funguses.
Yeah, yeah, or any of these various parasitic wasp interactions with a host, you know.
Okay.
Enslaves the host mind, then it alters the host DNA, causing it to pass on hybrid gene stealer genetics to its offspring while also infecting its mate.
Oh, that's interesting. So the person that it's infecting isn't just a host, like it doesn't implant an embryo in the body to, you know, develop there and then eventually burst out with lots of great joy and celebration, but it puts its genes into your genome.
Right. Yeah. And then after that, it alters the host behavior more, forcing them to care for this monstrous hybrid that's born, and then the monstrous hybrid and everyone else in this sort of growing gene stealer family continues to carry out the will of the hive mind, undermining defenses on the planet, producing less monstrous host from generation to generation until they just blend in perfectly, and until they're in the position to just unstabilize the planet enough for the full-blown invasion to hit.
I'm reminded of Patrick McGoohan in Braveheart when he's speaking of the people of Scotland. He says something like, if we can't get them out, we'll breed them out. And does his creepy mustache twirling.
Yeah, yeah, he would, that's pretty much the Tyranid approach here.
So it's, I'm going to take control of your genome by putting my own genes in.
Yeah.
That's pretty terrific. Now we have to say as a side note that Robert, you showed me a trailer to some non-existent movie that looked like VHS platinum.
Oh yes.
I loved this. What was the deal with this thing?
So far there has not been an official Warhammer 40,000 Gene Stealer movie.
Uh-huh.
But there have been some fan trailers over the years. And if you go to stufftheblowyourmind.com, if you just type in Gene Stealer, one word into the search bar, you'll find a couple of posts in which I've embedded this. But yeah, some fans of 40K made a fan trailer for a non-existent fan film about Space Marines battling Tyranids. Basically the Space Hulk board game scenario. And it's delightful.
It looked like one of those grimy, grainy, low-grade VHS movies you'd get from the 80s that had, you know, cyborgs in it. I think I've mentioned these before. They all came out after Terminator.
Yeah.
It's like once Terminator was out, bam, people knew what to do with their small budget for movie making.
Yeah, just borging it up out there. Making
right.
All these, you know, just throw some sort of a camera lens over your left eye and go at it.
Exactly. Tape some electronics to your body and you are Borg grimed to infinity. Also, I noticed that some of the costumes in this thing kind of looked like members of GWAR.
Yeah, and I don't...
Does Warhammer, did that inspire GWAR?
I don't know enough about Gore to comment on that, but I mean, Gore has that, they certainly have those like giant shoulder, pad kind of set thing going on, spikes that they do remind, either they were influenced by some of the space orc designs, especially in yeah. Warhammer, or it was the other way, or maybe it's a little bit of, transfer back and forth.
Oh, okay. Yeah. A little lateral transfer.
Yeah, I definitely get a Warhammer sense from looking at, Gore on stage.
Okay, well, sticking with sci-fi for just a minute before we get to the actual science, when I think about the idea of gene stealing in an alien species, my brain obviously goes to one of my favorites, which is the Alien universe, the xenomorphs of Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, and the others I don't pay attention to.
Which I should add was definitely an influence on the creation of the gene stealers in Warhammer.
Yeah. I can certainly see how that would be based on what you've described, because I am reminded of the alien life cycle. So what happens in the life cycle of a xenomorph? It's kind of like insects we know here on Earth, sort of,
yeah.
But with some kind of fantastical elements put in. But so you've got a queen that lays an egg. The egg hatches, and out of the egg comes a little scuttling creature called a facehugger. Mm-hmm. And this is a parasite that finds a host and attaches itself to the host's face, and then plants the seed of a larval organism inside the host. So grabs your face, it sort of squirts eggs in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And then down in your torso, the larval organism grows. This is known as a chest burster because it pops out of your chest, one in the most famous scene from the first movie. But it also seems to, at least according to, definitely by the third movie, this is clear, that it incorporates significant portions of the host animal's genome, or at least its hereditary traits, which would have to pretty much come from its genome, as far as we know. And so the chest burster emerges from the host, and it carries phenotypic traits of the host organism. So, for example, a chest burster that comes out of an adult human is bipedal. But an alien that pops out of a dog or another four-legged animal strides on all fours.
This is the example we see in the third Alien film.
Right. So it's obviously getting something from its host. It's not just, dwelling in the host, but it's learning something about body plans and behavior from the host organism. And that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, in sort of the alien world, depending on, you know, what origin story or origin theory you want to go with, like this thing is either evolved or designed to just wipe out a planet's native population.
Right.
And so it would make sense that it then steals from the most successful creatures on that planet.
Exactly. What better way to adapt to any native ecosystem than to steal the traits of the thing that already survives there?
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that's a really clever feature of the Alien universe design, and I've always kind of liked that. But here's where we get to the real science, because if we're talking about organisms getting traits from other organisms, typically how does that occur in nature? The obvious answer, the one everybody already knows, and the thing that's been talked about and understood in biology for decades now, or more than decades, I guess. Going back for a long time, we've understood the general principle of vertical gene transfer. Even before we understood what role DNA played in the transmission of genes and exactly how, even before Mendelian genetics, we had a basic idea that you can inherit traits from your parents.
Yeah.
So this is sexual and asexual reproduction.
Yeah, whichever brand of reproduction you prefer or practice, we're talking again about vertical gene transfer, up and down. Think of a family tree, right?
Yeah.
It goes down. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go sideways. It doesn't go up. It goes down.
Yeah.
A biological parent passes its genes onto its biological offspring. In the case of sexual reproduction, two sets of conspecific genes merge.
Right.
And in the case of asexual reproduction, you basically have kind of a cloning scenario on. They rely entirely on mutation for variation in their DNA. So there's very little differentiation in the offspring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many organisms also engage in both. It's worth saying you do have some very strictly asexual creatures out there. You have some strictly sexual creatures, but then you have some that engage in both, depending on what the reproductive climate happens to be.
Sure, like you might have a plant that can produce spores, but also do pollination, you know, sexual reproduction.
Like the Hydra, as I remember, is an example of this. Not the mythical Hydra, but of course the real natural world Hydra can reproduce asexually by budding, or it can reproduce sexually, depending on what it has at its disposal.
Wouldn't it be great if we had that option? It'd be so strange to live in a world where humans, so you can reproduce sexually if you want to maybe gain some resistance to parasites and strengthen your genome by recombination with another, you can sexually reproduce. But if you're in a pinch and you need to have kids and a healthy mate is not available, you just clone yourself.
Yeah, I think that's where we may be going, you know, and it's, I think it's not going to be that weird of a thing when it becomes a regular, viable, everyday option for personal reproduction.
Well, that probably deserves an episode of its own sometime in the future.
Oh, certainly. Yet even this near future cloning scenario we're talking about, this is still vertical gene transfer. It's still parent to child, parent to offspring.
Exactly right. And so this has led us to develop a sort of loose model of evolution of life on Earth that's referred to usually as the tree of life. This is evolution as Darwin imagined it in On the Origin of Species. Now, the subject of today's episode is going to complicate the applicability of this model, but we'll get to that in a minute. So what is the tree of life? The tree of life says parent organisms pass their genes on to offspring. So you have to imagine sort of an arrow starting at the top of a page and traveling down.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the process, variation is introduced through independent mutation. So there's an error in copying of DNA, and a random change is introduced for good or for ill, and then through natural selection, the advantageous changes are preserved and the ill changes are erased. And so eventually, over time, enough mutations enter the gene pool of an isolated population that it becomes sufficiently different that we consider it a different species, and then a new arrow splits off of the main arrow as it runs down the page, and this becomes a branch in the trunk of the tree of life. Now, you have to imagine that to account for all of the life on Earth, this is happening millions and millions of times, mapping out all of the organisms on the planet as branches peeling off of the trunk and off of other branches, just sort of pouring down the page like a genetic waterfall. And
ooh,
that's,
I like that.
That's the tree of life. But you notice that all of the movement on the page is, as we've said, vertical. It's going from the top to bottom. Now, what if there were a way to get genetic information to travel in a different direction along the page? Presumably, it can't travel from bottom to top, right? Because if the top to bottom direction is the arrow of time, essentially.
Yeah, then you're destroying causality and
exactly.
The universe turns inside out.
Yeah, so you can't travel back up the page unless you get a gene that gains a mutation permitting time travel. is that part of Warhammer 40,000?
Ooh, no. Nope, they, as far as I know, it isn't. But they do use Event Horizon style, faster than light to travel.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Oh man. Another reason I gotta check this out. But anyway, you can't go back up the page. But what if you didn't have to go straight down? What if a gene could travel sideways across the page rather than straight down? And this gets to the concept that we're gonna be focusing on today. It's horizontal gene transfer. So I want to back up and talk about a sort of fascinating precursor experiment to the main concept that we're getting to. And this is something that's known as Griffith's experiment. So in 1928, before we even knew that hereditary traits were passed on through DNA, an English bacteriologist named Fred Griffith published findings from a really weird experiment. And unfortunately, it involved killing some mice with pneumonia.
Well, that's going to happen.
Yeah. But anyway, Griffith started with two different strains of bacteria, which was Streptococcus pneumoniae. Is that how you pronounce that?
That sounds good to me.
Pneumoniae. I believe in it. Okay, so there are two strains of this bacteria. You've got an R strain, and that stands for rough. And this strain of the bacteria is harmless. You can put it in a mouse, and the mouse is fine. Its immune system takes care of it. It's just not a problem. But then there is an S strain, standing for smooth, and that means that this bacterium is contained inside a little capsule. This is a biostructure of a kind that helps the bacterium survive encounters with the host's immune system.
Kind of a suit of power armor.
It's like an armored exoskeleton for the bacterium. It allows it to resist phagocytosis, where the immune system cell engulfs and eats the other cell. And for this reason, the S strain is dangerous and it can kill any lab mice it infects. You take it on, you can get pneumonia and die.
Okay, so what did he find then when he injected this?
So he found you inject mice with the harmless R strain and they're fine.
Okay.
It's rough. It's not going to hurt them. You inject mice with the S strain, they get sick and die.
Okay.
You inject mice with dead S strain and they're fine. So you can cook the S strain to kill all the bacteria. And of course, this dead bacteria doesn't hurt the mice. You can dead S strain, no problem. But if you inject the mice with a combination of the two previously harmless injections, the R strain and the dead cooked S strain, the mice die.
So the harmless R strain is taking something. It's robbing the corpse of the dead S strain and taking something from it and incorporating it into itself.
That seems to be what's happening. It looks like the R strain bacteria are scavenging the dead S strain bacteria for the genes needed to produce those capsules to make them S strain bacteria that are virulent and will kill the host. And what do you know? Griffith looked at the dead mice from the final group and they contained live S strain bacteria, even though he had not put any live S strain bacteria into them. And this formed the basis of experimental confirmation for a process that would eventually come to be known as transformation. And they didn't have the terms to fully understand or describe exactly what was going on yet. You know, like I said, this was before we even knew that DNA was the thing that passed genes from parent to child.
Right.
But this was an example of what would come to be known as horizontal gene transfer. And so horizontal gene transfer, also known as lateral gene transfer, though I think I see the term horizontal more often used these days.
Yeah.
It seems like lateral is an older term. But it's the exchange of DNA between organisms of the same generation. So it's not that a bacterium divides and makes a copy of its genome, but that one way or another, some of its genes get inserted into the bacterium next door. So that's pretty weird and pretty cool on its own. So what are the primary avenues along which this kind of thing happens?
Well, there are several different HGT mechanisms.
Right.
But scientists identify three core transfer methods.
So we've got that first one, transformation, right?
Yeah, transformation. That's the uptake of naked DNA. And it's a common method, but it's mostly limited to bacteria. And it only permits the exchange of short DNA fragments.
Right, so these little sort of severed circles of isolated DNA known as plasmids.
Right. But then there's something called transduction. And this is the transfer of DNA from one bacterium to another via their bacteriophages. Now, generally, this requires close related bacteria, and the transfer size depends on the size of the bacteriophage head.
So this might be kind of a crude analogy, but for a crude analogy, imagine if you could take on traits of another person's genome by getting bitten by the same mosquito that they were bitten by. So in this case, you've got a virus, a bacteriophage that hits one bacterium, takes some of its genome, hits another bacterium, and now there's been some cross-pollination of the genes.
Yes. And by the way, I would love to see that incorporated into a vampire movie sometime.
Oh. Yeah.
But to continue, the third mechanism is conjunction. This is the transfer of DNA by plasmid from a donor cell to a recombinant recipient. And this one requires cell-to-cell contact, but it can occur between distantly related bacteria or even bacteria and eukaryotic cells. And it can transfer long fragments of DNA.
Okay, so this is something more like bacterial sex. And it's not really sex because obviously they're not sexually reproducing with full recombination like you know, humans would or something.
Right, but at the very basics of it, it's just kind of what's going on.
It's a conjugal union of prokaryotic cells. But yeah, as you said, this can apparently happen between even some prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells. The difference with that's something we're going to be talking about in this episode. The main difference being that a prokaryotic cell doesn't have a distinct nucleus, and a eukaryotic cell has a nucleus.
Yeah, prokaryotes include, microscopic single-celled organisms, bacteria and cyanobacteria. But then, on the other hand, the eukaryotes, that includes pretty much everything else.
Yeah.
Okay, so those are the basics. But we definitely want to stress that horizontal gene transfer is a subject that's continuing to evolve. Our understanding of it continues to evolve.
Yeah, it's in fact one of the, I would say, according to what I've read, one of the biggest and most interesting controversies in microbiology and genetics today.
Yeah, and we continue, as we'll discuss. I mean, there's some big findings that continue to come out as we map various organisms' genomes and discover, hey, there's some pilfered content in there.
Yeah.
We already touched on the early 20th century origins of this, really, our sort of our earliest understandings of horizontal gene transfer. Another big study that is often mentioned out there came in 1951, and that's when Victor J. Freeman published studies on the virulence of bacteriophage-infected strains of Corynebacterium diphtheria in the Journal of Bacteriology. And this was a paper that explored the manner by which avirulent strains of C. diphtheria infected with bacteriophage yielded virulent C. diphtheria strains.
Okay, so that sounds kind of like, sort of like the Griffith study.
Yeah.
Seeing how one strain of a bacterium can take on the properties of another one. But this time it sounds like it's talking about bacteriophage mediated transfer. So that's more that transduction method, you know.
Yeah.
The mosquito bites one bacterium and then another. Okay, but you may notice so far that we're primarily talking about prokaryotic life here, like we said, single-celled organisms like bacteria and archaea, and we've known for a while now that bacteria can trade genes horizontally. That's something that, as we've showed, we started to learn in the 20th century. But one of the most startling discoveries of recent decades is that we're starting to become aware how much horizontal gene transfer might actually be taking place and have taken place in the evolutionary history of eukaryotic organisms, more mm-hmm. complex organisms like plants, fungi, and animals. And generally speaking here, we're talking about the exchange of genetic material between different species. One species steals or lifts genes from another organism and incorporates the genes into its own genetic makeup. Now, at the end, I think we should talk about exactly how appropriate the metaphor of stealing or lifting is.
Yes.
because in many cases here, I think it'd be better to take a look at exactly what the real active agent in the process is. And of course, it's not going to be conscious. You know, you don't have an animal trying to steal the genes of another animal, as far as I know.
But that's the thing. The more examples we see of it, the more ubiquitous horizontal gene transfer appears to be, mm-hmm. you start realizing, well, this is not just some weird quirk that pops up among some, you know, very distantly related creature. This is more a part of the fabric of how life works.
Yeah, well, it's a thing that should come more naturally to our intuitions than it does, I think, because we tend to think of an animal or any organism's genome as a sort of like a platonic essence of what that creature really is.
Right.
But in fact, your genome is not an unalterable platonic essence. I mean, we know, of course, that it can go through recombination. It can, you know, be mixed up with another genome through sex. It can have mutations that are introduced independently. Somehow we've internalized all of those exceptions and said, well, that's normal. That's part of the normal,
that's normal genetic modification.
Yeah, that's a normal genetic modification. But you just don't get the sense that genes should be jumping between different species genomes like this. But it kind of makes sense because your genome is, it's molecules.
Yeah.
You know, it's physical matter.
It's not this little bundle of your soul coded into, these little drawings of DNA.
Yeah. And because it's molecules and physical matter, it is subject to physical contact and cross-contamination.
Yeah. But it's certainly, the more we discover about it, really, the more we're having to to reframe how we understand what life is and who we are.
Well, I think we should switch to looking at some of these examples of eukaryotic or more complex organisms that have been suggested as alleged gene stealers.
Yes, because for the same reason we started with a couple of sci-fi examples to sort of set the stage for what horizontal gene transfer is, the specific examples from the natural world, I feel like they work best to really let you understand what's going on and what the ultimate impact is by looking at specific examples.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to look at some brand new research regarding the old water bear.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back. Joe, you're familiar with the water bear, Der kleine Wasserbarren, the tardigrade.
I love tardigrades, man.
The moss piglet. the slow stepper, which I love because that makes the tardigrade feel a little, I don't know, like he could be a hip hop artist, you know, the slow stepper.
That's really cool. I love tardigrades. For a long time here at How Stuff Works, the background on my computer screen was a huge blown up, microphotography image of a tardigrade. And I don't know, something about these organisms is so cool. I always like reading new news about them, even if it's kind of boring news, honestly. It's like, study finds tardigrades live in a lake in Minnesota also. Yeah. You know, well, yeah, it's still tardigrades. I like it.
Yeah, they're pretty great because at one hand, they're very alien looking, and yet they wind up looking kind of cute. They look a little cuddly.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they simultaneously look like something that you want to cuddle, but that if they were big enough, they would suck all your liquids out.
Yeah. So when we're talking about tardigrades, we're talking about members of the phylum Tardigrada. And there are more than 1,100 species out there in that phylum that we know about.
And they're just pretty much everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you'll find them in moss and lichens and hot springs, Antarctic ice, deep sea trenches, Himalayan mountaintops. I mean, they're hardy little SOBs, and they can even, as I'm sure everyone is familiar with from headlines, they can even survive the extreme cold and radiation of outer space.
Yeah, I think they're often cited as examples of the kind of extremophile organisms that that people like to invoke when they're talking about things like the panspermia hypothesis.
Yeah.
You know, like the idea that that life forms, early incipient life forms traveled from planet to planet or from star to star on comets or pieces of matter through space. And you think, well, how could they survive that? People point to these really hardy organisms like, you know, a deep sea vent archaea or tardigrades or something, and say, well, look, this thing can survive almost anything.
Yeah. Because it's reasonably advanced, but very hardy.
Yeah.
And this is crazy. You can just find them about anywhere. And according to the International Society of Tardigrade Hunters, you'll find their website, by the way, at tardigradehunters.weebly.com.
Is that considered small game hunting?
It's a very small game hunting, yes. I'll include a link to that on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. But according to this website, you can find them yourself by following some basic instructions on their website. I'm going to read out the short versions here, but they provide more detailed instructions as well as some alternate user-submitted methods as well.
Uh-huh.
So you want to grab some terrestrial tardigrades. All you have to do is put a little lichen, moss, or whatever in a shallow plate of water. You agitate your sample, and you look through the debris at the bottom of the dish for tardigrades. Then you grab a microscope, and you look at tardigrades.
Uh-huh.
And if you want some marine tardigrades, you just go out to the beach. You wait till it's low tide. You scoop a bunch of sand at low tide, and you sort of work your way back up to the high tide mark. And then you shock them with some fresh water. This shocks them into letting go of their sand particles. And then you just grab a colander or a sieve, and you just start moving it around. Bam, you got some tardigrades. You grab a microscope, and you look at them.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to do that. Now, does it matter that you actually stand at the beach and wait for low tide, or can you just come back at low tide?
I think you just come back at low tide.
Okay.
But yeah, they're everywhere. And as we've discussed, they're hardy as all get out.
Well, I want to hear about some horizontal gene transfer. I assume that's what we're getting to.
Yes, they're because it turns out they have quite a bit of foreign DNA.
Okay.
Which the science headlines really had a lot of fun with this, saying, animal that can survive in space has foreign DNA, thus implying in the headline that they have foreign DNA from another planet.
Right.
But so this is not quite what's going on here, but it's still super exciting. This is very, very exciting end of the tardigrade news pool, I would say. So this is a new study that was published just in the last month in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and it's from the researchers from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So they sequenced the tardigrade genome, and in doing so, they found that 17.5% of the creature's DNA is foreign in nature. So they're nearly one-sixth stolen goods.
Man.
Yeah. So this is the new record.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because previously microscopic rotifers held the record for encompassing the most foreign DNA in their genome. But now the tardigrades come along, and they pretty much doubled the pre-existing score.
Wow. So now, hold on. Is that the record for eukaryotes, or does that include, like, bacteria and stuff?
Yeah, I believe this is the eukaryote record. Yeah.
I don't know what the number would be for prokaryotes, though. It just seems like with them trading as much as they do.
Yeah, my understanding is that it's higher among them. So, yeah, as it turns out, tardigrades acquire genes from various organisms. They get it from fungi, plants, archaea, bacteria. Those are microorganisms that are similar to bacteria in size and simplicity of structure, but they're radically different in molecular organization.
Mm-hmm.
But they mostly loot from bacteria. And the UNC researchers theorize that this just might be the source of the water bear's strength.
It's because they're gene stealers. They harvest the best genes from all the organisms.
Yeah, because when you look at life on Earth, like the life that's able to thrive in the most extreme environments, you know, be it around a deep sea thermal vent, or at the top of a mountain, the deepest part of the ocean, you're generally talking about bacteria, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so the theory here is that, yeah, they've basically stolen from the best. They've like the xenomorph. It has gone after one of the most successful organisms on the planet and said, hey, I'm going to take some of what's working for that organism, and then I'm going to work exceptionally well.
And as soon as the predators arrive, it's going to take their genes too.
Yeah. And then, yeah, the xenomorph is realistically going to win in any encounter. So how does this work? How does this go down? Well, the tardigrade, of course, is known for its ability to survive in extreme environments such as extreme cold, extreme dry situations. And when it does that, its DNA breaks up. And then when it rehydrates, the cell membrane and nucleus around the DNA becomes permeable enough for foreign DNA and molecules to leak through.
Whoa.
So as the tardigrade then rehydrates and essentially regenerates, it stitches its own damaged DNA and any foreign genetic bits together into a single patchwork genome.
Now, it sounds to me, I don't actually know this from the research, so I'm just guessing here. It sounds to me like that might be kind of a high-risk strategy, like high-risk, high-reward.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you just described, even though it might, in many cases, grant you access to some very useful genes that help you survive in tough environments, it sounds like it can also likely cause bad copying problems and introduce garbage into your genome and kill you.
Yeah, a lot of brundlefly tardigrades
right out
there, you would think. And then those would die out. And it would be the other strains that would survive.
Or I don't know, maybe it's got a good mechanism for making that not such a low risk thing. That was just I wonder about that.
Well, it does make me think back to how many different tardigrades we have. Again, over 1,100 different species that we know of.
Uh-huh.
So that seems to balance well with this idea that, that they so easily can start incorporating new DNA via horizontal gene transfer. So that's a tardigrade, again, a fabulous animal that probably deserves its own podcast episode outright.
Uh-huh.
But we know now, we knew it was an amazing critter before, and now we know that it is engaging in horizontal gene transfer. What else do we have on the superstar list here, Joe?
Well, how about, I love this example because do you love coffee, Robert?
I know
the answer. yes, you do love coffee. Of course you do. But do you know how much you should hate the coffee berry borer beetle?
I do not.
Well, the coffee berry borer beetle, also known as Hypothenamus hampei, it's this tiny, tiny beetle. Like, adults are between 1 and 2 millimeters, and it's a horrible, horrible pest on coffee crops. It is just the bane of coffee growers' existence. It's native to Africa, but now it lives pretty much anywhere coffee is grown. And this beetle isn't just a pest, it is a gene stealer.
Ah.
So in February 2012, research published in PNAS revealed that the coffee berry borer beetle is a known case of an animal. So this is interesting because it's an insect. It's a fairly complex animal.
Yeah, we're moving up from tardigrades and certainly from some of the earlier examples.
Yeah, it has stolen demonstrably beneficial genes from bacteria. And that's an interesting thing to point out. It's not just that it has a gene that looks like it came from bacteria, but we don't know what it does or it doesn't really help. It has a gene that very clearly helps the beetle survive. So it acquired a prokaryotic upgrade pack. So the bacterial gene that the beetle has incorporated helps with the digestion of a particularly difficult food, the carbohydrates found in coffee beans. And you might be thinking to yourself already, well, yeah, I love coffee, but a creature cannot live by coffee alone. like how much usable food energy is really there in a coffee bean.
Yeah.
I love coffee, but I would not want to try to survive on coffee. that would just be a constant horrible existence of the fear coming in waves and waves. But the coffee berry borer beetle happens to have a gene known as HHMAN1, or man, would you say it, man? HHMAN1, which allows it to make a protein called mannanase, not mayonnaise, but mannanase. And this protein is used in digestion to break down and digest a kind of nasty polysaccharide sugar called, and I didn't make this up, galactomannan.
Oh, galactomannan.
Yeah, before doing this episode, I'd never heard of galactomannan before. I looked it up. They were not playing a joke. This is not an April Fool's article. That's the real name of that sugar. So the scientists believe that the beetle gene somehow came from the beetle's own gut bacteria. So, small-scale hybridization with one's own endosymbiont.
Wow.
This is a weird universe.
Yeah, because I mean, we've covered on the podcast here, and I feel like a lot of our listeners have probably, you know, caught on to the growing body of science surrounding our own microbiome. But we still kind of think of that as this internal population, but not a population that's going to upgrade into management, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. So the question is, how do they know that the beetle's gene for digesting this horrible sugar found in coffee beans came from the bacteria, and it's not just some, you know, mutation or insect gene or something? Well, from what I read, I believe they're not 100% sure it came from the bacteria, but they think the evidence is pretty strong that it did. And the evidence includes the fact that the gene is not otherwise present in insects. It looks very similar to the bacterial gene for breaking down galactomannan. And the scientists discovered that the gene sits bookended by two sections of genetic code known as transposons, also known as jumping genes. And so transposons were identified by the geneticist Barbara McClintock in the 1940s in corn. And I was just thinking we should do a whole episode about Barbara McClintock sometime.
Okay.
It would probably be the most interesting way you can possibly discuss corn for an hour. but anyway, so transposons, what she discovered, this is the name for genes that can travel around and insert themselves into different places within a genome. They're molecularly apt to move and insert in different places throughout the genetic code. So there we have an indication of alien DNA in the beetle plus a plausible method for insertion into the animal's chromosomes, at least at that level. But this does bring up an interesting question in the idea of horizontal gene transfer in complex animals like insects. How does it become part of the animal's genome from generation to generation? The prokaryotes are single-celled organisms without a defined nucleus, and they can pretty easily incorporate new genes into the genome. But with eukaryotes, how do you get the fugitive gene into the chromosomes inside the nucleus? And then furthermore, it's more complicated than that because you need to get them not just into any nucleus, not just in like the nucleus in the cells in your arm or something. If you want it to become part of the genome of the species continuing throughout the generations, it needs to get into the chromosomes in the nucleus of the germ cells, like the sperm or egg cells. And as far as I can tell, how this happens is not yet very well understood. Unless there's research I'm not aware of yet, and if any of our listeners know about that, we'd love to hear about that, because this part is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
How do the genes get in there for complex reproducing animals?
Yeah, because there's no alien species coming in and shoving its ovipositor in or launching anything onto your face.
So you can see at the molecular level how it might work. Mm-hmm. If you've got transposons at either end that can, you know, so you can see how it fits into the genome once it's there, but how does it get to the genome? I don't know. There may be an answer to that I'm not aware of yet, but very interesting question, at least.
Yeah, indeed.
But hey, those are not the only examples of gene-stealing animals. What else? Animals, plants, and all kinds of organisms. What else have we got?
Yeah, for starters, we have Asian clams. They're strictly asexual, but these hermaphroditic mollusks spice things up a bit to avoid just complete genetic stagnation.
Okay.
And so in this case, it means a little gene theft.
Oh.
While they generally fertilize their own eggs, they sometimes fertilize those of another clam species, and this gives the resulting offspring an injection of fresh alien genes.
Nice.
We mentioned rotifers earlier, the Deloid rotifers. Sometimes they're referred to as the, quote, ancient asexuals.
I don't really know anything about these. What's the deal?
Oh, they're pretty cool. They're an all-female species of near microscopic animals, and they've been sex-free for about 80 million years. And they're a variety of them, and they look really cool, when you look at their bodies. Under a microscope. And as we previously noted, they used to have the record for the most pilfered genes among the eukaryotes. According to a 2012 University of Cambridge study, that number was 10% of their expressed genes were pilfered from roughly 500 other species. So they incorporate foreign DNA from fungi, plants, and bacteria, of course, while they're patching up their own ruptured cell membrane. So
weird.
So very similar, it sounds like, to what we were discussing with the tardigrades.
Okay.
Then there's Galderia sulfurari. These are a single-celled red algae that thrives in sunlit hot springs, but it also manages to stay alive in deep, dark depths. And the algae simply stole some genetic traits from simpler bacteria and archaea organisms.
Okay.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier, connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Up next, this one is a very exciting organism to mention here, and that is Alicia chlorotica. So if you ever see a sea slug with the power of photosynthesis, you can rest assured that they stole it, right?
They stole it. So photosynthesis.
Yeah. the domain of plants.
Yeah, I typically think that as sort of a fundamental separator indicator for plants versus animals. So a plant can photosynthesize. It has the chloroplast that it needs. Animals don't have that.
Except this one does because it stole it from algae. They actually produce chlorophyll. They're a chlorophyll-producing mollusk. And the slugs even pass the chlorophyll-producing trait onto their offspring, though they have to eat a bunch of algae to actually carry out that photosynthesis. But, yeah, this is like an obvious trait. Like, it's one thing to say, oh, well, it turns out this organism, it has some traits that it stole. Like, this one, you could tell something is weird is going on. It's like a turtle on a fence post. You know, you don't know how it got up there, but you know it had some help. And in this case, the help came in the form of horizontal gene transfer.
Nice. I'd actually read about that one a little bit before, and that struck me as one of the weirdest and most interesting, because that's you know, one of the things that I've noticed in some of the literature is that most often these stolen genes tend to have something to do with digestion or metabolism, which I think is interesting because most of the time they are coming from simpler organisms like bacteria or something. So you're not going to steal a gene for, I don't know, making stag horns or something like that from bacteria. But very likely you might steal a gene for being able to process a certain type of molecule into food.
Yeah.
And so that makes sense. But here it's not a digestion molecule for like, for a different type of sugar or something. It's for sunlight itself. I don't know. I find that very interesting.
Well, you know, it's only fitting that since we started off talking about the alien xenomorph.
Yeah.
Which, of course, has a lot in common with various parasitic wasps.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfect that we also get to include a little parasitic wasp action here.
Right. In Science in 2009, there was an article called Polydnoviruses of Braconid Wasps Derived from an Ancestral Nudivirus. And that suggested that there are these parasitic wasps that that they inject host caterpillars with these virus-derived particles that inhibit the caterpillar's immune system so that the wasps can implant their eggs in the caterpillar, and then the eggs can hatch and eat the caterpillar from the inside and get a nursery, get a wonderful little corpse nursery.
Right.
And so where did the wasps get these virus-like particles that they inject into the caterpillar in order to inhibit the immune system? Well, the discovery is that the wasp genome learned how to make these particles by incorporating the genome of a virus about 100 million years ago. And so the suggestion is that it pulled in the virus's genome, said, "You're part of my body plan now," and used that to make a byproduct of the structure of this virus to use as a weapon against these caterpillars.
Wow. Now that is incredible.
Yeah.
And up next, we have a plant. This is it's not quite as exciting as parasitic wasps, but it concerns the sweet potato.
Is this a sweet potato that stabs you with virus particles?
No, fortunately not. Fortunately, it hasn't picked up that habit. But a 2015 study by Ghent University and the International Potato Institute, or CIP, SIP, they should have got a chip in there, an H in there somehow to make it chip.
International Hot Potato University.
Yeah. Oh, they published in the journal PNAS and revealed that sweet potatoes from all over the world naturally contain genes from the bacterium Agrobacterium. And in this particular article, they even go so far as to say that you could consider this a, quote, natural GMO food product.
Yeah, the implications for GMOs are kind of interesting because what a lot of people seem opposed to about GMOs, I mean, there are a lot of different reasons people give for being opposed to transgenic food crops, but a lot of it is just kind of like, that's not natural.
Right.
It's not natural to put genes from a bacteria or a fish or something like that into a plant in order to make it, you know, do whatever, be a more successful crop, be resistant to herbicides or pesticides or whatever it is they're doing with it. Now, I do think people should be should have concerns about the methods used to produce the food they eat.
Right.
But this one particular concern, like, oh, you know, transgenic crops, that's not natural. That seems untrue. It kind of is natural for plants to get genes from other places.
Yeah, I think that's one of the that's one of the lessons that this topic gives us, you know, that we learn that this the horizontal gene transfer means that this kind of genetic modification occurs naturally, and it's not merely to the domain of very ancient organisms or entirely fictional organisms. It seems to be a part of life itself.
Yeah. So one of the strange things that you might be starting to wonder is if eukaryotic organisms like plants and animals and fungi, if they swipe genes from other organisms, does that mean that even the human genome contains a decent amount of foreign DNA? And the answer is quite possibly.
Huh.
Just this year in 2015, there was a paper published in Genome Biology called Expression of Multiple Horizontally Acquired Genes is a Hallmark of Both Vertebrate and Invertebrate Genomes. And they combine previous and new research to suggest a running total of 145 genes in humans that they think have leapt into the human genome from simpler organisms at some point in our evolutionary past. An interesting thing they point out is that fewer HGT genes seem to have showed up in the recent history of primates. I want to read a quote from their findings. They say, genome-wide comparative and phylogenetic analyses show that HGT in animals typically gives rise to tens or hundreds of active foreign genes largely concerned with metabolism. Like we were talking about earlier, a lot of these seem to have to do with how you can digest and make energy out of different kinds of foods. But picking back up with their words, our analyses suggest that while fruit flies and nematodes have continued to acquire foreign genes throughout their evolution, humans and other primates have gained relatively few since their common ancestor.
Huh.
So I interpreted this to mean that as eukaryotes become more complex, their rate of gene stealing can generally be expected to decrease. So I could be mistaken about that interpretation, but that's what I took away from it.
Well, yeah, I couldn't help but think of gene theft in these organisms, like thinking of each organism as, say, you know, a castle or some sort of a game, like some sort of a game scenario, right?
Uh-huh.
Like it's one thing for all this level of theft to be going on in, you know, among some crude huts out there on the plain, but then for it to take place within the castle walls,
uh-huh.
for it to take place within the castle itself, for it to take place in the king's bedroom,
yeah.
Or in the throne room, perhaps would be a better analogy. It becomes increasingly more difficult to imagine it, and maybe that's the case.
Well, yeah, and that is sort of what I was talking about earlier when I was bringing up this weird concern about, you know, we have cell nuclei, we have, you know, we have all these things that would seem to make it harder for this kind of genetic cross-contamination to occur.
Yeah, so like we're trying to figure out, yeah, what's causing it, what exact mechanism is taking place. It's kind of like looking at the scenario and saying, how's the thief getting in here?
Yeah.
Where is he or she hiding?
Yeah.
What's the escape route? We're trying to understand exactly how that works.
Yeah, and so one thing about this last study I mentioned is it should be pointed out that I read at least a couple of comments from scientists essentially claiming not to be convinced that the authors had shown that these genes in complex animals like humans were products of horizontal gene transfer. For example, there was a Science Magazine news write-up of the study that cited a dissenting opinion from the microbiologist Jonathan Eisen. And while he didn't rule out HGT in complex animals, he wasn't like, that can't happen. He just felt that the authors of the paper hadn't sufficiently ruled out other non-HGT explanations for the presence of these seemingly alien genes.
Okay.
But anyway, that's an interesting frontier that I think the science is still developing, and I'll be very interested to see what else we learn and what comes of more review of this type of science. But I want to get back to the analogy I brought up earlier in the episode. This model that has been so common in evolutionary thinking really since the time of Darwin, and it's the tree of life analogy. It seems that we're discovering all the time that even complex eukaryotic organisms trade genes with their contemporaries. And if this is true, I think it might be the case that the tree of life model, you know, flowing unidirectionally from trunk to branches, from top to bottom, isn't necessarily the best analogy anymore. Instead, maybe it should be more like the tumbleweed of life, where there is sort of a basic one-directional flow of the branches. They don't go back toward the roots, but there's a whole lot of perpendicular cross-connections and knots and tangles, and that there might not be a single trunk at the beginning, but rather another strange knot of traded, crisscrossing genetic pathways.
There's a great piece that came out in Ian Magazine. It's a December 2014 essay called The Gene That Jumped by Farish Jabbar. And I wanted to read just a quick quote from this. And we'll be sure to include a link to this full essay on the landing page for this episode. Jabbar writes, quote, "Standard evolutionary theory does not account for the possibility of complex organisms suddenly acquiring genes from other species, let alone how those foreign genes might change a creature for better or worse. Think of it this way. If the genomes of living species are flowers on different branches of the great evolutionary tree of life, horizontal gene transfer is a subversive wind whipping pollen from one part of the tree to another."
I think that's beautifully expressed, and I really, really liked this essay. I recommend our listeners to check it out because I think it's an excellent overview of the subject we've been talking about today.
Yeah, so if you find yourself thirsting for more about this topic and you're not sure where to go next, I would highly recommend that essay.
Okay, so there's one last thing I do want to bring up before we conclude our discussion of horizontal gene transfer, and it's something about the analogies we've been using. Mm-hmm. Throughout this episode, we've spoken of the whole organism as a gene stealer. In the case of this horizontal gene transfer, I'll take a gene from you, I'll take a gene from you, and I'll make it part of myself and pass it on to my kids. But I wonder if it would make more sense to think about it backwards. Instead of gene stealers, whole organisms as gene stealers, to think about a gene invader looking for a suitable host. Because from a certain point of view, you can say it's not the individual or even the entire genome that is the agent driving evolution, but it's that each individual gene within a genome competes for its own survival and reproduction. So if you think about each genome sort of like an ecosystem for genes,
right?
If a gene can survive outside the original ecosystem where it originated by invading a different genome, why wouldn't it do that too? Why not spread to more fertile territory? And if it contributes to the overall health of the ecosystem in this, and that would be the analogy, but meaning it provides a survival advantage to the owner of the host genome, all the better. So I think that's another interesting way of thinking about it, to sort of flip this on its head, because we know certainly that these organisms are not attempting to steal genes consciously.
Right.
But the genes are out there, and that the whole complexity of biological life is driven by the desire of each gene to make as many copies of itself as possible. And we've discovered a new way it can do that. It doesn't just divide and copy. It doesn't just sexually reproduce, but it can also kind of drift. It can also invade and take over somebody else's house and become part of the new neighborhood.
Yeah, I love the way you put this, because it does, I mean, it drives home how difficult it is for us to take into account that there's no consistent us. That we are not set in stone. That certainly, and that works on several different levels. I mean, the me that I am now is not the me that I was 10 years ago, or the person I'll be 10 years from now.
Yeah.
We're this continually changing individual, and even that individual is kind of a council of selves. And then even the individual body, we've discussed the micro genome. We've discussed all the individual parts that make us up as a whole. We're essentially this large corporation of smaller things. And so, when one employee jumps and joins this corporation, we might think, oh, we have acquired an individual. We've acquired a trait. We've acquired a skill set into our being. But then on the other hand, there is an individual worker who simply said, hey, there's a corporation that I can thrive in.
Right.
And I'm better at doing what I do than several of the current employees. I think I could carve out a place for myself in this new home.
Yeah. Economics starts with the individual, right?
Yeah. There you go.
So really, we are like the Warhammer 40K universe. We're taking bits of Tolkien. We're taking bits of Conan the Barbarian. We're taking bits of Alien, of Event Horizon, maybe of Coneheads. Why not Coneheads?
I would love to see a Conehead army in the Warhammer 40,000 universe.
Coming straight from France.
Yeah. But yeah, I think Warhammer 40,000 is an excellent metaphor for the sort of a view on life that horizontal gene transfer gives us, that all these elements come together, and even though they're all kind of pilfered and stolen and acquired, they all take on a unique form of life in the ultimate individual that you see, in the ultimate franchise that you play with on your tabletop.
I was about to say that's deep, but instead what I'm going to say is that's broad.
Well put, well put. All right, so there you go, horizontal gene transfer. And again, we'll include some resources for you to move on to if you feel like you want some more depth on this particular topic.
Right.
In the meantime, again, head on over to stufftheblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, blog posts, videos, links out to our social media accounts, you name it. Again, the landing page for this episode will include probably some sort of cool little picture and some links to related podcast episodes, articles, etc. on the website, as well as links out to some key resources we think that you will find engaging, such as that Ian Magazine piece.
And if you want to get in touch with us and let us know your favorite gene stealer in science fiction, or fantasy or horror, or if you want to let us know about your favorite gene stealer or, let's say, genetic invader in real life nature, you can email us and let us know at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.